Not so long ago, if you dropped out of high school, you could still manage to find a good blue-collar job. But today, the people who seem to be hurting the most in our sputtering economy are dropouts in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. Despite their work experience, some can't even apply for a new job without proof that they completed high school. In his final story for our series on dropouts, NPR's Claudio Sanchez profiles a man who's thought a lot about a decision he made as a teenager.
Kenny Buchanan has lived in the Coleridge Mountains of Schuylkill County, Pennsylvania, all his life. He's 44, talkative, in a good way, and happy that he's working after being jobless for more than a year. Kenny recently found work at an aluminum manufacturing plant.
I'm a processor. In other words, we make aluminum for propane tanks, runways, aluminum runways for the United States Air Force.
It's not a permanent job yet. Kenny's still on probation. It's the eighth job he's had in the last 5 years. He leans forward, adjusts his baseball cap, and says, with a wife and two kids, it's been rough. All because of a decision he made 26 years ago.
I actually dropped out of school. Ninth grade, I dropped out of school. I was 18. I flunked twice. I had no interest. And I went home and I told my mom, because I was living with my mom at the time, I said, I'm done. I'm not going back to school.
Kenny says he didn't think about how this would limit his job prospects down the road, because right after he dropped out, he got a full-time job at Burger King.
Back then, I could get a job anywhere. You know, I could work at Burger King, quit that job, and have a job the next day without an education.
Kenny says he's always been a hard worker with good references, but he's never had a steady job.
I worked in foundries. I drove forklifts, operated overhead cranes.
And in the last few years, finding work that can support a family has gotten even harder. Employers in Schuylkill County have started asking for a high school diploma.
I'd go to a different job, and there were several jobs, good-paying jobs I could have had. But because I didn't have a high school diploma, they wouldn't even consider me.
Kenny is one of 40 million Americans who never graduated from high school. According to the American Council on Education, most of these people, 60%, are between 40 and 70 years old. 9 in 10 have never earned more than $40,000 a year. That fits Kenny to a T. It's depressing, he says, especially when he'd run into his old high school buddies, the guys he could have graduated with. Someone would always ask,
what are you making? $7 an hour. You know? And it hurts. It's embarrassing, you know?
So 2 years ago, Kenny did something about it. He sought help at CareerLink, a state-run job training and education center for unemployed adults in Pottsville.
When you guys applied for unemployment benefits, you were laid off, work was slow.
After an orientation class like this one, Kenny realized he needed to earn the closest thing to a high school diploma, a GED. But like most adults who never finished high school, Kenny also realized his reading and math skills were not very good. Sharon Angle, the director at CareerLink, says people like Kenny need lots of help.
Because when you get that GED book and you look and you see the math that's required, algebra, trig, I think that scares a lot of people, especially if they haven't been in school for 30 years.
Angle says a lot of these older dropouts give up.
They'll say, you know what, I'm just going to get a job here and there, pick up what I can, and just hope that I make it to 62 until I could get on Social Security.
And employers who come to the center looking for workers get frustrated too, she says.
To be honest, they want someone that they could depend on, someone who's going to show up and give them a good day's work.
But if they don't have a high school diploma or GED, that's it. No interview, no job. Angle says that's the new corporate policy most of the businesses she deals with have adopted. The flip side of that, of course, is that businesses are sending an important message, especially to kids. Stay in school, get your diploma, and then get a job. It's a good message, says Kenny, but boy, it couldn't have come at a worse time.
Around here, there ain't a lot of jobs. Everything that gets built around here is strip malls, little strip malls, $7 an hour jobs. How can you live on $7 an hour?
Kenny says that's why the kids who are graduating from high school are leaving Schuylkill County, including his oldest son. He's thinking about college. Even Kenny's wife wants to move to Florida if possible. But Kenny says he's staying put. If he's hired permanently at the aluminum plant next month, his family will finally have health insurance and enough to live on. Kenny says he's just praying the job lasts.
I'm a religious man. And when all else fails, God's always there for you. You know, I mean, he's been good to me.
If he didn't have his faith to fall back on, Kenny says, it would have been a lot easier to give up, to stay stuck, poor, and miserable.
Dropping out of school, that was one of my biggest mistakes I've ever done. What I did, you know. But I can make things better.
Kenny believes he has made things better. He got his GED. He says his friends and family respect him for doing that. Kenny knows he may get laid off again, but he says the stigma of being a high school dropout has faded forever. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
So maybe this wasn't art to British justices, but that stormtrooper helmet may have fit the bill for this exhibition. Modern by Design at the High Museum in Atlanta is elevating the utilitarian. It shows museum-quality objects that have been affordable over the decades, either as originals or knockoffs. These are not Rodin sculptures or Renoir paintings. These are ordinary 20th century items which the Museum of Modern Art bought for its permanent collection and is lending now to the High Museum. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg went to see him.
All day long in the lobby of the museum, an adorable little orange robot with a long arm is assembling 40,000 small metal squares, one on top of the other, into the shape of an 18th century French Rococo-style table.
You know, I've never interviewed a robot before.
She's quiet, the robot, but has a great work ethic. Dutch designer Joris Laarman built her for this Modern by Design show on commission from the High Museum. Someday, the Dutch designer believes, we will all have such small robots and make our own tables and chairs and anything else that strikes our fancy. That is design in the future. Some past designs are at the heart of this show.
Wait a minute, look at that. What is this axe doing in the middle of a museum? Wait, and then there's a sewing machine.
And the blade of a saw. And from 1941, a Chemex coffee maker, a big Pyrex glass beaker with a wooden belt around its tapered middle and a narrow leather strip tied around the wood.
It's something that lived with and loved.
Michael Shapiro, director of the High Museum, remembers a knockoff from his student days.
This kind of thing, which had a sense of utilitarian purity, simplicity, made great coffee, and it was nothing more than almost like a chemistry set. It was just beautiful.
But to put it in a museum, a spatula, poultry shears, a soup ladle, such ordinary, everyday objects. Michael Shapiro says their designs make them special.
Simple, pure, honest, direct craftsmanship is sort of like what Frank Stella said about his paintings in the early 60s. What you see is what you see. This is what it is. This coffee maker is what it is. This axe is what it is. This sieve is what it is. It's nothing more than what it is, but we can make it simple and beautiful.
From the first and groundbreaking 1934 Museum of Modern Art design show, a no-fuss black spring from a railroad car.
It's like a slinky gone mad.
Yeah. You know,
it's a slinky that went to the gym for 2 years.
Also on loan from MoMA, that first modern design show, something Michael Shapiro calls radically simple, a gleaming silver sculpture that is, in fact, the aluminum propeller of an outboard motor.
It's a fan, really. Right? It's a fan for pushing water. But when you're tired of the boat, you can just take the propeller off and mount it in your home, in your living room.
You know, I just think the word modern and modernism is confusing. I always thought modern meant this minute, but it doesn't.
I think contemporary means this minute. Modern really means a historical period leading up to the present day.
Modern, the period, begins in the 20th century. So if you grew up in the 1950s, in today's, i.e. contemporary parlance, that is mid-century. Just to make the more mature among us feel truly modern. In Atlanta, visitors of all ages are coming to see this Modern by Design exhibit. The High Museum has an ongoing partnership with the Manhattan Museum. MoMA gets new audiences for work that may be in storage in New York. The High gets great stuff. They had Monet water lilies from MoMA 2 summers ago, which attract visitors from all over the Southeast. And Atlanta design curator Sarah Schlinning says, an exhibition like this one gives museum goers some aha moments about how they live.
I think in the end, What these shows suggest is that we have a choice of what we consume, what we wear, what we surround ourselves with, furniture and objects, and that there are good design choices you can make, whether they're expensive or not.
If you think about it, everything around us has been designed. Someone, somewhere, has chosen that color for the side chair, that shape for the luggage tag, that typeface for the bus ticket. The 150 hand-picked 20th century objects on view at the High Museum in Atlanta are examples of how to live with art in and out of museums. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
The Atlanta exhibit runs through August 21st, and if you can't make it there, you can see a few of the designs simply by going to npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Obama is expected to announce new fuel economy standards for cars and light trucks tomorrow. As NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports now, this deal comes after weeks of negotiations with automakers.
The agreement would kick in 2017. By 2025, the average vehicle will go 54.5 miles per gallon. To get there, cars would have to improve their fuel economy by 5% per year. Light trucks would start out at 3.5%, but increase to 5% later on. The White House didn't officially announce the deal, but sources close to the talks outlined it for NPR. And environmentalists like Brendan Bell from the Union of Concerned Scientists were briefed at the White House.
Your car is going to go further on a gallon of gas. You're going to spend less at the pump. You're going to have cleaner air for your kids, and we're going to be less reliant on oil as a country.
Bell says Americans will have to pay more to purchase new cars, but savings in gas will add up to thousands of dollars over the life of a vehicle. It's the second fuel economy agreement that President Obama forged with the auto industry. The first one will boost average fuel efficiency to 35 miles per gallon in 2016. Chrysler says it supports the deal. Automakers say it won't be easy to meet the requirements, but several are expected to give their endorsements by joining the president for the announcement. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The journalist Juan Williams is out with a new book. In it, he makes the case that his firing last fall by NPR was part of a pattern of suppressing unwelcome opinions by the network. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik recently sat down with Juan Williams, and he has this report.
The overall theme of the book, Muzzled, is that reasonable people are being shut up and shut down. Today's media landscape, Juan Williams says, feels like a New York City street.
You hear the cabs honking and the kids screaming and the ice cream truck with its melodies. You can hear everything out here. And I think to myself, but David, I think the experience most Americans have is that they bite their tongue on a regular basis.
The first chapter of Muzzled focuses on Williams' firing as a senior news analyst at NPR, which he says exemplifies the pressure on people throughout society to censor themselves. In his case, Williams blames what he says is a small group of elitist liberal news executives who didn't like when he expressed his opinions in other news outlets, including the Fox News Channel.
I think that what was behind it in the mind of the executive that fired me was my willingness to work for Fox and to engage conservatives and to stand up and make arguments that oftentimes were construed as conservative arguments, whether it was on Fox or in print or in books.
In Muzzled, Williams writes that editors were unhappy with his previous book, Enough, in which he criticized liberal black leaders. Williams, himself black, says he was told by an NPR executive whom he would not identify that he was not in sync with the kind of African Americans valued by the network. Yet NPR's Morning Edition devoted 7.5 minutes to an interview with Williams about Enough, and used it to kick off a week of stories about leadership among African Americans.
NPR is a stunningly open-minded place.
Margaret Lowe Smith is NPR's acting senior vice president for news.
We're deeply appreciative and, in fact, encouraging of different points of view. Everybody knows that we apply journalistic rigor to absolutely every story we tell. We challenge our own. We challenge each other's assumptions every day in the way we report the news and the way we lead this organization.
NPR officials terminated Williams' contract last October. Fox's Bill O'Reilly asked him, what was wrong with saying Muslims killed us on 9/11? Williams said, not to worry.
I mean, look, Bill, I'm not a bigot. You know the kind of books I've written about the civil rights movement in this country. But when I get on a plane, I got to tell you, if I see people who are in Muslim garb, and I think, you know, they're identifying themselves first and foremost as Muslims, I get worried. I get nervous.
A minute later, Williams circled back, telling O'Reilly it was important to distinguish between a terrorist and a faith, saying Americans did not blame Christians for Timothy McVeigh's deadly attack in Oklahoma City. But critics said Williams was encouraging racial profiling. Ellen Weiss, then NPR senior vice president for news, called Williams to cut his contract short. The ensuing outcry from journalists and conservative lawmakers cost Weiss her job and helped fuel the later departure of CEO Vivian Schiller in March. These days, no one at NPR defends how Williams was fired. Williams writes of his fears for his career and wrote he was concerned he'd be considered bigoted. He found widespread sympathy from journalists, including Clarence Page, a Pulitzer-winning columnist for the Chicago Tribune. But Page also notes Williams' two-book deal, his newspaper column, and his three-year contract with Fox News, worth a reported $2 million.
I have a hard time seeing Juan as being muzzled. I have no quarrel with NPR or Fox News deciding what's going to go out over their air and who the people are going to be who are going to put that stuff out over the air.
The media critic William McGowan is author of the book Gray Lady Down, which contends the New York Times is compromised by liberal bias. He thinks NPR leans to the left and should have leapt at a chance for its journalists to appear on Fox shows with conservative hosts.
I listen to it at a discount, but it's got a lot to offer. It is not the great Satan that the right wing on Capitol Hill made it out to be.
Williams' central contention that people are muzzled occurs amid the presence of cable channels and websites feeding almost every ideology or interest, and the ability of non-journalists to find audiences on Twitter or Tumblr. He says ordinary people in the sensible center get steamrolled, yet he says he's a fan of Fox's high decibel approach.
I think that you've got to have strong personality, strong points of view, in order to succeed in this media landscape.
That's a central conflict. Margaret Lowe Smith says NPR wants to draw clear lines between opinion, that is beliefs, and analysis, providing context and insights. This week, Williams has been making the rounds to make his case about his beliefs and to promote Muzzled in print interviews, on Fox News, on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, on NPR's Diane Rehm Show, and on other public radio programs. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.